Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack.
Welcome back, listeners, and a very special welcome back to two-time guest Edward Ashton to talk about his amazing new book, which hits shelves in April, Mal Goes to War. Ed, I am so happy to see you. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
It's great to have you back and everyone else out there. You know Edward Ashton from his two previous appearances here on Top Shelf for his books, Mickey 7 and the follow-up Antimatter Blues, both of which feature everyone's favorite expendable Mickey 7. And Ed has two other books that are must-reads, 3 Days in April and The End of Ordinary. Oh my gosh, those books are amazing. And you can find more of his work on his website. So please check that out. But today we are here to talk about his brand new book that hits shelves, as I said, in April. So let's jump right in. Ed, please tell us about Mal Goes to War.
So Mal Goes to War is, in my mind at least, a sort of a fish out of water story, except the fish is an artificial intelligence and the water that he's out of is his natural environment, which is the information web, the sort of worldwide web. And he finds himself caught in the middle of a war that he wants nothing to do with and has no real stakes in at the beginning of the book, which is a battle between two factions of humans set about 50 years in our future at a time when people are beginning to genetically modify themselves. They're beginning to add in mechanical electronic augmentations, brain implants, things of that sort. And there's a big faction of people who are very strongly against this. This society is broken down into a sort of elites versus the more economically disadvantaged people who can't afford these sorts of augmentations. And these people have realized the fact that economically privileged people already have so many advantages over them. That's really just being accelerated by the fact that now they can literally make themselves stronger, faster, smarter. And they're realizing that they're losing their place in this world. And so they've launched an armed insurrection to end this. And it becomes incredibly violent, very fast, atrocities being committed on both sides. Mal, who is a free artificial intelligence, doesn't really feel like he has a part in this, but he's not above scouting the battlefield for salvage because he has an interest in inhabiting things, in inhabiting bodies and machines and other things, more or less for his own amusement. And he finds himself, because of an abrupt cutoff of access to the information space, trapped in the body of a dead cyborg mercenary who he learns very quickly was responsible, who died protecting a young girl who is modified and is caught behind the lines of the unmodified forces. And so he finds himself saddled with the responsibility now of protecting this girl and getting her to safety, which he at first is very reluctant to do because, again, he feels like he has no part in this. But over the course of the book, he learns a little bit about what being human is. And we learn a little bit about how a completely alien mind would see us and would see the way that we behave towards one another. And it gives me a chance to step outside of the sort of human concerns and give a little bit of perspective on how absurd some of our conflicts can be.
I love that you said Mal doesn't have a place in this until he does, right? This book is action packed and it's fun. Well, it's fun for me, maybe not so much for Mr. Pullman. We'll get to that later. But the book is also, it's a dark comedy and it's wrapped, like we've said, in this techno thriller. And taking us on this journey is Mal. And he has such an incredible voice. And the way you write him, his perspective, readers will love Mal. I almost feel like we should have t-shirts that say, be like Mal. When does Mal start forming for you as you're writing other Mickey books? Like where's that timeline? And then talk about writing him.
So the character and the seed of this book actually goes back quite a long way. I wrote the first few chapters of this book in 2015. So there's a deep genesis here. I was really interested. I've always been interested in the idea of alien minds. I explored that a little bit in the Mickey 7 books. I wanted to go into it a lot more deeply here. The idea that, because, you know, in science fiction, very frequently, aliens and non-human intelligences are just presented as humans in rubber suits, like what you see in Star Trek, where it's just gets a person with some stuff on his face or something. And to me, that's not particularly interesting, because any mind that was formed by a completely different process, a different biological process, a different artificial process than ours, is going to see the world in a very different way and is going to experience the world in a very different way and is going to think in a very different way. And I really wanted to try to explore that through the idea of an artificial intelligence. How would an artificial intelligence perceive the world, and how would it perceive us? And so I, like I said, I wrote a few chapters this back in 2015, and it wasn't clear to me at that time. I liked the character, but I wasn't sure where the plot should go. So I set it aside for a long time. And I came back to it a couple of years ago. And after having gone through the experience of writing three other novels in the interim, probably my plot formation engine is a little better now than it was then. And I was able to get a better vision of where this character could go and what could be really fun plot arc for this character. And the idea for the book fully formed itself in my head over a very short period of time. And I was able to write this really quickly. It only took me about probably 5.5 months from start to finish this book, which is fast for me. I know that may be slow for somebody like John Scalzi. I know he wrote Kaiju Preservation Society in 1.5 weeks, but you know, that's not something I can do.
It's fine. It's the product that we have, Mal Goes To War, is absolutely 100% fine. So in 2015, Mal starts to form. Over that time period, was he like talking in your ear? Because I would think he would have some definite suggestions about the story, the plot. Like, is he talking to you during all of this, so to speak?
I don't know that I would say that necessarily. The way my brain works, as far as I can tell, is that I get these ideas and they sort of sink into the sediment at the back of my brain and just ferment back there. And it's not really a conscious process. I don't think about it much, but stuff is clearly going on, because at some later time, like, it rears its head back out of the muck and it's much more fully formed than it was when it went under. And that's really what happened with this character and with this plot. It just sort of came up and out of the muck to me, and I saw where it needed to go. But obviously that was a process that had been percolating in the background for a long time.
And there are so many reasons to enjoy your books, not the least of which is the dark humor. In the book, the chapters have the most engaging titles, right? So I wrote a few down, and listeners, when you get to them, you'll understand the context, because you don't understand the context. But chapter 3 is Mal Experiences Unexpected Weight Loss. Funny. Chapter 9, Mal Takes Up Hiking. Chapter 12, Mal Reassesses His Relationships. And I mean, oh my gosh, for this AI to have these human experiences, it's just great what you did there. Were these chapter headings, these chapter titles, were they always there? Did you put them in later?
The chapter headings were put in after the chapter was done. As you said, this book is a lot about Mal trying to understand the human experience. And as you point out, a lot of those chapter headings are sort of banal things that humans do from time to time. And this is Mal getting to experience these things for the first time, typically in a pretty unique. I mean, the way he experiences weight loss is not the way you and I typically experience weight loss. It's his own take on these banal human experiences.
I love them, especially the reassesses his relationships. Good grief. I mean, it's just like a Cosmo headline. You know, it's like Cosmopolitan writes ahead. It was just so funny and cleverly done. What made you think to put those in for the reader? Like, what was your thought process there?
I don't think too much about this stuff. It just felt like the right thing to do. I did that for the first couple of chapters, and it seemed like it was working. As you know from the previous books, usually my chapters are just numbered. I didn't put titles on there, but I don't know, for whatever reason, for this book, probably because of the arc that Mal is experiencing of going from having no idea what a human is or how humans experience the world, really, to having a much better feel for it at the end of the book, I sort of wanted to illustrate that journey on a point-by-point basis as we go through the chapters.
It works beautifully, absolutely beautifully. I want to move on a little bit to Kaylee and Pullman. And oh my gosh, those two, you know, Pullman, he's described as this short, pale, doughy person. And his stature comes into play in a very humorous way later when Pullman sustains a wound. But there's No spoiling. I won't say anything more about that. Kaylee, as you mentioned, she's this child. She's got this red hair and a ponytail. She's missing a front tooth. She's got these freckles. She's adorable. And the images that I had, the visual images of Kaylee and Pullman and the three of them doing this journey together. I like the exchange between Kaylee and Mal. And Kaylee says, "We're a charming pair." "We are," Mal says. "Well, together we are in any case. You look charming, but are actually a soulless monster. I look like a monster, but I'm actually delightful in every way."
Now, he's again, he's not really perceiving the situation accurately in that case on either front, either his perception of her or of himself. Neither one is actually particularly accurate, but
and he's very again, serious.
He's still learning to see the world. Yeah, he's still learning to see the world, and he hasn't quite got it down yet.
Oh, my gosh. And it's beautifully narrated by John Perala again. I think he's been in a couple of the books and Catherine Chin, both of them terrific in that book. So listening to John Perala narrate that is far better than I could read it, but it's a great scene. And then there's another scene about halfway through the book, and we find our merry band inside a cave for various reasons. Oh, gosh, Mal, I love him. Mal says, "Not a cave. A natural rock shelter. There are important geological differences. Also, my understanding is that caves are frequently full of bears. Rock shelters, on the other hand, are typically full of Neolithic artifacts and spiders." Ed, spiders.
Yeah, I don't like spiders.
I know.
Spiders are an issue for me. I'm the first to admit that. As a writer, we tend to write our own neuroses and our own fears. And so, yeah, you're going to see spiders. Anytime I want to come up with something creepy, there's going to be spiders involved in there somewhere. I apologize to any folks who may be in the fan base, but that's just how I roll.
I have like six different post-its with arrows pointing to the spiders. And I actually, when I got to that scene, yelled out, "Ed, oh my God, you know, why are you doing this to yourself?" Tell me about Pullman developing him and writing him. He's human. He's an everyman. He probably lives in your suburban town. So talk about him a little bit.
Well, as you said earlier, it's not an unserious book. I've got some serious things to say. It is also a comedic book in a lot of ways. And one of the classic formulations in terms of comedy is to have a straight man, right? And Pullman serves that role in this group. When everyone else is bouncing things off and being absurdist, Pullman is the one who doesn't get the humor, doesn't understand why any of this is funny, and just wants it all to stop. And having one person like that in a group is kind of necessary when you're doing these kind of comedic riffs. So he is the stand-in for the audience in a lot of ways, who's observing this kind of absurd progression of events and like I said, just really sort of wishing it would all end.
You also have a very interesting character who shows up at the end. His name is Captain Merrick. What a character. And I also think it's such an interesting name choice.
That was entirely subconscious. I don't know. Maybe we can say it's a shout out for you. It was not intended.
Okay. Well, I'm taking it anyway. We'll see, somewhere in the back of the brain, there was a shout out for Merrick. Talk about choosing this title. Was Mal Goes to War the title? Was that always going to be the title?
No, that was not the original title. Titles are a bit of my Achilles heel. I have rough go with titles. When I start a book, I typically put a working title on it, which is often just the name of the main character. Mm-hmm. That's where Mickey 7 came from. That one actually stuck. I thought that one actually turned out pretty well. For this one, I had a slightly different title, which wasn't too far off of this one, but my editor thought it was a little too close to some other books that were out there already and maybe didn't quite convey what we were trying to convey in terms of the content of the book. So
love that, because it is spot on. Now, tell me about this cover.
Yeah, I was really excited about this one. Again, covers, the author typically doesn't have a big involvement in that. There's a whole department at the publishing house that handles those covers, but they do let us look at some choices and sort of pick what we think is better and worse. And for this one, if you look at the cover right now, you've got the head that's kind of floating up there over the scene of devastation. The original cover suggestions were just the head on like a blue background. And then there were some others that were just the woman and the child walking through this disaster scene. And I have a friend who's a professional artist. Her name's TJ. I consult with her on a lot of these things because she has just a beautiful eye for color and things like that that I don't really have. And she looked all these things over and she said, look, what you need to do is bring these together, because the head is Mal sort of overlooking everything from above. But then you also need the devastation on the ground that he's seeing. And so putting the two together, I thought we really got an encapsulation of what's going on in the book. And also, it just kind of looks cool. I mean, I was really pleased with the visual impact of it.
Especially on the side of Mal's face. You know, you've got what looks like that Tron look. It has, oh my gosh, I just dated myself. But it has that sort of, it's what it reminded me of. Do you think you're going to be using Mal going forward? Is he sort of done for the day kind of thing? Or is he sort of staying there in the background for you?
That's always an open question. I try to write every book as a complete standalone. And I know different authors have different perspectives on this. Different readers have different perspectives on this. But for me, when I read a book, I want to come to the end of the book and have a complete story with no dangling to be continued stuff hanging around. I don't want to wait a year for the next book to come out to find out how the story ends. So this is a complete standalone novel. Doesn't need any follow-on. But there is enough left open at the end that if I want to continue with these characters, I could do so. From a business decision perspective, a lot of that, whether that would be permitted by my publisher, has to do with how well this book does. If this book blows the doors off, they might be more amenable to seeing another book in space. We won't know anything about that for another year and a half. Now, as far as this book goes, I can tell you my next book has already been turned in. That's already with my editor getting edited. The next book after that, I have just drafted the second chapter. That's in process. Neither of those are related to this. So there are two more complete independent standalone novels coming at least before we would see anything else here. So I've got some time to think about it, basically.
Oh my gosh, two books on the way. So when is it anticipated that the one that's with, I guess, your editor now, when does that hit?
We don't have a release date for that one. My guess, and this is only a guess, again, not based on any inside information, is that they're going to try to time it somewhere around the release date of the movie Mickey 17. That is my guess. But that the final decision on that is obviously up to my publishers.
Got it. And do we have any information on when I thought Mickey 17 was going to be released sometime this spring, but I guess that changed. Anything you can talk about regarding that release date?
Yeah. The movie is coming out on January 31st of 2025. And there are a bunch of reasons for that. I think part of it is that director Bong is, I mean, he's an artist and he wants to have every single frame of this film looking exactly how he wants it to look. And that's just, that's a longer process than if you're just sort of slapping something down on film and throwing it out there. And it takes time to get everything exactly the way they want it. In addition, I think there is some, the release is timed with the Lunar New Year celebration.
Right.
And because director Bong is such a huge celebrity, particularly in Asia, my understanding is that Lunar New Year is a really big movie going time in places like China, Japan, Korea, where his celebrity is absolutely enormous. And I think they wanted to time it around that holiday, you know, around their holiday schedule rather than our typical holiday schedule for those reasons.
And have you done any book tour or Zoom sort of events with Asian fans of yours?
I've had a lot of interviews with folks in Korea. The book actually was, you know, Mickey 7 was a national bestseller. It still is a national bestseller in Korea. Obviously, more due to Bong than due to me, which is totally fine from my perspective. So, yeah, I mean, when the book came out, I had interviews with the largest newspaper, the largest television stations in Seoul. I've had additional interviews with them with around Antimatter Blues. Antimatter Blues was just released in South Korea, I think about a month ago. It's been a very big deal. I mentioned at one point the Korean army actually bulk purchased about 11,000 copies of Mickey 7 to distribute to the soldiers, which I'm not sure I understand, but I really appreciate the sentiment. So so it has been a really interesting experience to have so much international exposure to my work. I mean, it's been translated into, I think, 23 languages at this point, which, considering that previously my work had been translated into one language, and I'd said some German stuff in English, and that was it. This has been a really interesting experience. And the task of marketing to these different regions, different cultures, different holiday schedules, all this other stuff, it has all been very educational for me. It's been interesting to watch.
Yeah, I bet. And it's interesting to listen to, I'll say that. So with all of this that's going on, I don't know how you find the time to read anything, but do you have any recommendations that you'd like to share with listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, this book, Mal Goes to War, is a lot around looking at how a mind other than our own perceives the world and how that mind perceives us in particular, how that mind would see humans and how it would interact with us. And there's no one in the world who does that anywhere near as well as Adrian Tchaikovsky. So I've been on a little bit of an Adrian Tchaikovsky kick recently, in particular, Children of Time, Children of Ruin, Children of Memory trilogy that he put together. Just absolutely brilliant in terms of looking at how would an intelligent spider see the world? Very different than the way humans would see that. How would an intelligent octopus, intelligent corvid? I mean, I think we've already got intelligent corvids, if I'm being completely honest here. But an octopus is also, they've got a lot going on in there as well. But, you know, looking at an octopus has one big brain and eight small brains, which are constantly in conversation with one another. We know this. How would that change the way that you see the world? Rather than sort of having one decision maker, every decision you make is a negotiation among nine different brains. That has to be just an utterly alien way of perceiving the world. And Tchaikovsky really gets into the head and the arms of a creature thinking that way and illustrates how that changes the way that that creature would see the world. And I just have immense admiration for that, for the work that he does. And I highly recommend those books to anyone who will listen to me.
Well, we're listening and I will be passing those out. We have them, almost all of them, on the shelves. So that's an easy one. As your book tour is about to kick off, where is the best place for people to find you for your upcoming events?
Obviously I do a lot of stuff here in Western New York because that's where I live. I'm going to be in Brockport for the solar eclipse. We'll be signing books at Lipbridge Bookshop on the weekend before the solar eclipse. We're under the path of totality. So we're sort of expecting to be swarmed by people. They're expecting to have 100,000 people in Brockport, which is Brockport's a very small town. That's a lot of people for a town of that size. So hopefully a few of them will stop by and I can sign some books for them. I'm going to be in Leipzig, Germany, September 29th to 31st for there's a literary conference that goes on there where I'm a featured guest. So if you happen to be in the Leipzig area, that's something to put down on your calendar to stop by and say hello. I'm sure things will fill in as we go.
And the book hits shelves April 9th. So I will post all of the information on the podcast page for this episode. Listeners, Mal Goes to War by today's guest, Edward Ashton, hit shelves, as I said, in early April. So please pre-order your copy today at your local independent bookstore and please request it from your local library. If audiobooks are your thing, as they are for me, it is narrated by John Perala and Catherine Chin. What a terrific listen, Mal Goes to War is published by St. Martin's Press. And I just want to give one last quote from Booklist. Booklist calls Mal Goes to War a funny, fast-paced, fish-out-of-water tale that should satisfy Ashton's growing fan base. And boy, am I glad to be counted among that number. Ed, I'm so appreciative that you came back for your third tour here at Top Shelf, and I so look forward to your next project. I'm really excited that you shared that news. I really hope you'll join me for a fourth visit.
Of course I will. I was really honored to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity as always.
Oh my gosh, listeners, thank you so much for joining both of us today. Remember to follow Top Shelf at Merrick Library wherever you find most podcasts. For the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library, check out our website at merricklibrary.org. Thanks to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmere, Assistant Director Miera Broderick, and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and on to the airwaves. Until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf.